ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The AFP is looking into allegations Israeli forces sexually assaulted Australian activists who were detained after attempting to reach Gaza last month. That's a claim Israel denies. It comes as the US and Iran electronically sign a ceasefire agreement, modern times, with key details to be ironed out ahead of a formal signing ceremony on Friday. Meanwhile, back home, there's been a heated exchange over the capital gains tax discount and negative gearing inquiry, with the shadow treasurer telling a government minister to grow up and get a breathalyzer. So is the tone of our political discourse hardening? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelis.
And I'm Melissa Clark.
And Mel, things got very fiery during a regular morning kind of panel, you know, in the morning, and actually on my show too, an afternoon briefing, they put two politicians together and sort of hammer out some issues. And we had Tim Wilson, who is the shadow treasurer now, and the workplace relations minister, Amanda Rishworth, come to blows. That's one thing that happened. We're going to revisit that in a moment.
That's good, because I've got a lot to say on this. I think you do too, PK.
Oh, look, I've always got views. but first, overnight, Australian activists who claim they were sexually assaulted by Israeli forces met with Federal Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong and Multicultural Affairs Minister Anne Ali, as well as senior members of the AFP. That was a meeting in Parliament House. It's been described as emotionally charged. The AFP then confirmed it has begun inquiries into the allegations. They put out a statement saying inquiries were underway in line with a victim-centric, trauma-informed approach, and they will provide an update at a later time. Now, this, of course, is significant because this kind of obligates Australia really to put pressure on Israel about the treatment of our own citizens. An Israeli embassy spokesperson has categorically rejected the allegations, saying they had already been proven to be false. But Mel, this meeting, even that the meeting happened, is a significant development.
It is. Look, the meeting was always going to take place, but it was always going to be a difficult one because the activists who were making these allegations were always going to make requests of the federal government that they were never going to meet. So the question was, how could they have a meeting that came away that was satisfactory for both sides? Now, this got put off the week before. The weeks are blending for me, PK. There was the Minister Wong was tied up with Senate estimates for a long time, and that took up much of her diary. So there was frustration from those who were on the flotilla who wanted to meet with her earlier. She said they were given opportunities, but her calendar was very restrained, being tied up with Senate estimates. So they found a reasonable time at a reasonable hour of the day for both sides here, and I think a bit of coordination to allow the AFP to be there as well was probably an approach to try and offer something to this group who have very serious allegations to make about how they were treated, have given very detailed accounts of that treatment, and such accounts warrant further investigation. So we have seen that now. There's an AFP probe that has begun, rightly so. The activists came away frustrated that some of their other requests weren't met. They welcomed the fact that Senator Penny Wong said that they believed their accounts of their kidnapping, their descriptions of how they were treated and the sexual assaults that they have described experiencing. So they've welcomed her support in that and welcomed that there's an AFP investigation. But they were looking for more than that. They wanted the Australian government to publicly condemn the actions. The government's not willing to do that because it says it warrants investigation but needs to see an outcome from that investigation. They also wanted the Israeli ambassador to Australia expelled over this. That's something that the government was clearly not going to be willing to do one without a finalised process of testing these allegations, but also that would be a very extraordinary step to take because of the implications that would then have on our diplomatic relationship and the pathways for continuing to have a dialogue with the Israeli government. So I think from the government's point of view, this meeting probably went how they had hoped, which was to be able to offer support for an investigation but not agree to further actions. For the activists, they were clearly hoping for more from the federal government for this, that behaviour that they have described, that other activists outside of Australia have described experiencing as well, warrants a greater level of condemnation. But politically, I think that the fact that they've got an official Australian investigation underway at least continues to see that there is ongoing a process of trying to address and hold account what has happened. But the prospects of the AFP being able to get very far is obviously going to be limited by what Israel is willing to offer to support that investigation. And I think there's a pretty big question mark that might really be the limiting factor in where this goes from here.
I think being able to get any results out of this is going to be very hard in terms of if these allegations stand up, you know, actually consequences. However, I do think it's important for people that their government is advocating for them and pursuing their interests at the sort of international level on these issues. And so I think the government's met these people where they need to be met. I can't, you know, there might be some criticism around the edges, but I think broadly we are seeing a government act as it broadly should. If we can, like, just pivot to the broader issues involving the country of Israel at the moment, and some, you know, ongoing tensions between both Israel and the US, and that's actually playing out right now. Look, we'll see where this goes, but, you know, Israel is saying Hezbollah has attacked troops in southern Lebanon. This coming as, of course, the US wants to sign, seal and deliver this peace deal with Iran. This is quite a disruptor, I've got to say, this kind of ongoing skirmishes that Israel is involved in, and Hezbollah, if that is, you know, exactly what's happened. And I'm basing this on reporting right now that's unfolding. But this deal that we're seeing is so empty in terms of facts and detail, and it seems like Trump was so desperate to get a deal, we really haven't got much of an idea of what the deal is. I mean, he said today it's like a page and a half, it's electronically been signed. This is a man who just desperately wants to get out of this theater of war, doesn't he? He's just like, oh man, this is like, he just wants to slam this door shut.
I think you're absolutely right. And we're left wondering. So, yeah, we've heard it's a page and a half. We haven't seen publicly what's on it. We've got no comprehensive account from anyone about what's on it. We've got some suggestions from the Pakistanis as the mediators here about what it might include, some suggestions from Donald Trump around, oh, we're going to immediately, you know, lift the blockade on the Strait of Hormuz. Well, of course, ships aren't travelling smoothly through the Strait of Hormuz right now, so it's not clear quite what that means. We know that Iranians speaking to their own state media have made some suggestions around what it might include, but again, it's not entirely clear to us about what their key issue, the ceasefire including Lebanon, how that is exactly worded and how this might bind Israel, given that this is an agreement that's been negotiated between the US and Iran, and we've seen limitations on the US's ability to keep Israel on its plan towards a peace deal. So we don't really know what's in it. We don't know how committed either side is to sticking to what is in it, which we don't know. And then there's still a very big question mark of, even if we're optimistic about it, which I think we want to be, optimistic about the prospect of at least being able to have a ceasefire extended, get into serious negotiations about the really difficult parts, but what the level of commitment is to that from the parties themselves when they're still a million miles apart on the key issues of Iran's nuclear ambitions, what to do with its current stockpile of enriched uranium, Israel's intentions in southern northern Lebanon going forward, even if we're optimistic about the next couple of days of getting to Friday and this signing ceremony in Switzerland, what happens after that has even more question marks on it. I'm sorry, I'm trying very hard to be optimistic, but I am finding it difficult.
It is very difficult. Because all of the questions you raise are legit. And then there's, of course, you know, what pertains to us in a really direct way, which is the ramifications in our economy. Now, you know, on that question, we're recording this before the Reserve Bank of Australia lets us know what they're going to do on interest rates today. We'll let you know what the political fallout will be. You know, most money, as you know, Mel, is on them holding rates today. But what they say in their monetary statement about how they view this deal and the future trajectory of inflation will be fascinating, because clearly the economy is slowing. I mean, you know, there's no doubt about it. Is there enough, though, to actually put a bit of a dampener on inflation? I'm not sure, especially given the homegrown element. And then the fuel excise, because the cut to the fuel excise we saw, which was introduced by the Albanese government to help us deal with, you know, skyrocketing petrol prices during the war, that's due to end. Now, yesterday you would have heard on the pod us mention, Jacob and I, that the Prime Minister was basically saying in coming days this will be, and I thought that was very soon, coming days, makes sense, close to the end of June, where they have to tell people what will happen. Today, the Finance Minister, Katie Gallagher, did the morning media rounds, and she says keeping it like that cut, you know, extending it, basically, if I can put it bluntly, keeping you have cheaper petrol.
I think that's a very, very concise description.
they're considering that. But she also said, and I really read a lot into this bit, Mel, I don't know about you, but she also said, but, you know, it was always meant to be temporary, you know, and obviously there's a really good off-ramp, I think, for the government personally with the war ending. Like, that is such an obvious off-ramp, isn't it?
So there's a lot of things I want to say here. Before we get into the detail of the excise, I just want to say I think a lot of people right now are doing exactly what you were doing then, PK, which is I'm trying to read into the words of what a government minister has said. And we've just had a succession of everyone from the Prime Minister to the Treasurer, the Finance Minister, and any other Cabinet Minister that pops up in the meantime of what's happening with excise. They give this sort of delicate line about, well, we always said it was going to be temporary, but of course we're always considering cost of living pressures. We intend for it to come off, but of course a decision hasn't been made yet. And so everyone is trying to parse these very delicate lines to see what's underneath them. And ultimately, we know the government hasn't actually made a decision yet on whether or not it's going to extend the excise. That's likely to come next week when the Expenditure Review Committee meets. So we're still away from that. So in the meantime, I think we're seeing a lot of trying to read the tea leaves. And there's been quite a few stories in the media this week that I've looked at. So I'm going from political analysis here to media analysis. But I think there's been quite a few stories this week that have perhaps overread some of those comments, which are really just holding lines from cabinet ministers saying we haven't made a decision yet. Here's what we said when we first announced it. We're still looking at what we're going to do. So now I've got that off my chest, my concern about the reading into the lines. I mean, the government is actually in a good position if it wanted to remove the excise politically, because if it came back on at this point, the amount that it would add to petrol prices wouldn't put it back up to that sort of very high over $2 a litre kind of figure that psychologically I think is a really big barrier.
If I see it over $2, ask my psychologist.
Panic.
I go into a meltdown with a petrol car. Like I do. I go, no. So, yeah, you're right. If it's got a one in front of it, you can kind of manage it, can't you?
Yeah, and I think at the moment, because the government has, and this is credit where credit is due, they've done a good job of getting extra fuel supplies in, extra petrol and diesel and crude to be refined here, that we have had a bit of a buffer from that thanks to the government's efforts around importing petrol products to Australia, that the price is lower, you add on a bit more now, you will avoid that psychological barrier. So the couple of other questions are, well, is that also a bit of an inflationary hit that might cause issues for the Reserve Bank? Again, I think the government's in a good position where the Reserve Bank is possibly more worried about slowing economic activity and broader global implications, that maybe that's not going to be enough to tip them into raising another rate hike. So the government's weighing up that kind of calculation as well. But I think we should note that it's not just the fuel excise that you're paying on petrol. We've also got the heavy vehicle road user charge. Mm. It's quite possible that they will say, sorry, end of the road for the fuel excise discount, but heavy vehicle road user charge, given that can flow on to things like food prices because of the movement of goods and produce around the country, that we're still worried about. That's something that they could continue a
now
discount
you're
for
talking
longer.
Mel Clark.
You think that's what's going to happen?
I do.
It's definitely an option.
I do.
On the table.
I think their big concern is absolutely the flow on to the inflationary consequences on goods basically that you go to the supermarket to buy. Absolutely. And so that's why you're hearing. I don't actually think there is an overreading of the hedging. I disagree with you politely.
Mm.
I think they are hedging and they are.
No, I think they are hedging.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't think you can draw a conclusion from their hedging. And I think everyone's looking for a conclusion in the hedging.
Well, the conclusion is yet to be designed because
exactly.
It's in live time, right? But
yep.
It's, yeah, watch that space anyway until the decision's made. But I do think they don't want to upset industry that's already quite upset over lots of other things going on in the budget, for instance, and they just want to make sure that on that question they are able to have an answer, because there is a massive flow-on effect on what you pay at the supermarket. I mean, that's real.
Absolutely. And look, there's one more thing before we move on, PK, that I think is worth mentioning. There is a lot of attention on the fuel excise. Like, it is pretty expensive, right? It costs, I think it was $2.5 billion just for this 3 months of relief. But whatever happens with that, a lot of the other settings are going to stay in place. Things like the fuel security services payment, which is basically underwriting the costs for refiners, that potentially can cost a lot more money. The money that is being spent underwriting these additional shipments coming to Australia, that is, we don't have all the details because a lot of it is commercial in confidence, but that is likely very expensive as well. So even if the fuel excise discount comes off, there is still a lot of government money being spent on trying to ensure that Australians have a bit of a buffer from these prices. And that is something that the government still has to manage when it's looking at its budget.
Now, Mel, it's the final day of the two-day inquiry into the government's proposed CGT negative gearing changes. And before proceedings got underway for the day, this morning things got really heated. I wasn't watching this. Just want to sort of tell you how the sausage is made. I wasn't watching this in live in time. I wasn't watching the Today Show this morning. But I did catch up with it later, and I was genuinely a bit shocked at just how much this escalated. So it's an exchange between the Shadow Treasurer, Tim Wilson. He lashed out at the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations, Amanda Rishworth. It was a lot of finger pointing and shouty sort of stuff, and I thought, you know, I've watched Tim Wilson in his evolution from young man to older man, mid range man, and yeah, I think he's done a lot of work on himself. I think that's how he won back this seat, for instance, off you know, Zoe Daniel, Teal Independent. I'm giving all this background to say that I was a bit surprised that he let it go this far. I think he could have scored his points without going this far. He repeatedly interjected. He seemed really bombastic, and he berated her. He told her, yeah, get real and grow up. Now, I understand that he wants to win an argument, but I learned pretty early in my life that when I yell at people, they find me annoying. I mean, I've done yelling, I know. I just learned that you just need to do less of it, right?
It's a good life lesson. Your lesson is power when you do it all the time as well. But
yeah.
It's another conversation.
Yes. Perhaps. So he also said this one thing I didn't even get it, actually. I was like, I rewatched it over and over thinking, is he sort of implying that she's drunk? But I realised then he wasn't, or help me, maybe he was. He said, Amanda needs to get a breathalyzer.
I think it was intended as a throwaway line.
He's right.
Like, oh, grow up, you get a breathalyzer, you're talking rubbish. But it is so loose to be bordering on offensive. I mean, it could be defamatory. I mean, you could make the case that he is defaming her by even as a joke, if that's how he wanted to characterise it, suggesting she was drunk in doing her duty as a minister talking to the media. So I think it's really problematic to have throwaway remarks like that in a national media approach. I think there's a really serious question about the decision to do that. But I also want to make a bit of observation about it coming from Tim Wilson in particular, because I think we've seen in recent months two different Tim Wilsons. And I think we've seen Tim Wilson appearing on commercial breakfast television, in some press conferences. And I think that's a different Tim Wilson that appears on some ABC programming, for example. We saw Tim Wilson just last night on 7:30 with Sarah Ferguson. This was disciplined Tim Wilson. This was, I'm clear on the message. The language was reined back in. He didn't use his quotes about death taxes and liars and some of the more hyperbolic language. He doesn't use that in interviews that he has done on 7:30, that he's done with me on AM. Not sure about you on Afternoon Briefing, PK, but in some settings he chooses to be very disciplined, pulls back the rhetoric, focuses on the detail. And then in other circumstances, like these kind of television breakfast interviews, he's happy to go in and be looser, be a bit more of the fight, the challenge, use the stronger language. I think he's doing it deliberately to pick his audiences. I think he's thinking about who's listening to which media appearance he's making, and I think he's trying to shape himself according to the audience that he thinks he's hearing. What do you think about that?
I think your theory is a good one, and I don't think he's the first politician to do that. I mean, even the Prime Minister, I see the way he answers questions when he's kind of on FM radio versus to shock jocks in the commercial space versus to me. It's all a different vibe. So I think the smart politicians do think about tone and the way to present things. So I get that he's like approached this particular interaction in a more fighty way, yeah, to, if I can use that term, old-fashioned term-ish, fighty way to meet that kind of commercial morning, fiery kind of, it has to be, let's not forget, like, why do you think the commercials invite these people on? It's not just accountability. It's a bit of political entertainment, right?
So yeah, they want to grab people's attention while they're making breakfast, in the car, doing three other things. They want someone who's going to pop out from the television screen and grab your attention, and a really detailed debate about tax rates might not quite do that.
Yeah, and also then there's the other thing, which I just think is a bigger kind of point I want to make about how to win this debate if you are against these changes. If it's true, and I think there's some evidence that there is some truth in this, that some of the public feels either enraged or very suspicious about some of these changes, then kind of let them, like, it's let them undo themselves, this being the government, if they've breached it. I think some of the hyperbolic extremity, you know, he's trying to sort of channel the small business people being outraged, is kind of unnecessary because it's happening anyway. You don't need to quite play that role. Is it the biggest deal to people? Just noise probably to most people, but I just, as a strategy, am not convinced it actually wins you any extra votes.
Look, the thing that jumps out to me is just how much more we're seeing this hyperbolic language. I mean, it's always been present in politics, right? It's a pretty robust place. You want to make a point, you often try and go for the most, you know, eye-catching way you can do it. Sometimes you exaggerate things to make a point. But the kind of language that we're hearing more now, I'm hearing phrases like, it's a stitch-up, it's a sham, it's corrupt, they've cheating you out of your earnings. And I think there is a difference when you go from, these people are bad and their policy is wrong, to this is words like corrupt, or you've been cheated out of something, because it does kind of give that suggestion of criminality. Even if it's not meant as a literal interpretation, I think it just ratchets up the language to a point where we're not actually debating the substance anymore. We're just throwing around allegations that don't do anything to help people's trust in the political debate that's happening. If all you're hearing about political opponents is that they're accusing each other of corrupt behaviour, or they're hearing that one side or another is cheating another out of each other, the impression you're giving the public is that all politicians are doing something bad and wrong, rather than having a disagreement about how we should manage our tax system or how money should be distributed amongst. Now, maybe I'm being a little high-minded here, PK. Maybe I'm being a little bit naive, but I do think when our language deteriorates to that point, we're just getting too far away from what the political debate is meant to be about, which is, how we divide power, how we divide resources, and actually having a genuine discussion about that.
Yeah, I don't like it either. And a lot of people, I think, don't like it. I think it actually puts people off politics a lot too. There is a sort of angry thing going on in the community at the moment, though. So maybe Tim Wilson thinks he's, I'm being a bit generous here, but maybe he's trying to channel a bit of that anger too, right? Like we're seeing rising, burn the system down anger, and he wants to sort of be a leader of that dissent. Yeah?
I think that's probably reasonable. And if people are angry, you do want to see acknowledgement of that from our political leaders and our political class, right? So you could make an argument that there is a role to play in helping express and demonstrate that anger. But I think we're just getting so far away from where we are. I mean, if we want to look in the broader political sweep, the thing that's actually been argued about in this tax debate is whether or not capital gains tax should be taxed at a discount that goes to inflation. Is it a discount that goes to a flat 50% rate, or is it a we account for indexation but have a floor of 30%? They're actually quite narrow differences on the political spectrum. Like, we're talking about the fine detail of where the calibration is. Now, for some people, yes, this is going to have an impact on how you might deal with a receipt of an asset and the profits you make
what
from that down
they
the track.
Put in their pocket.
But in
the
political
end.
Spectrum, we're actually arguing over a fairly technical detail where there is broad agreement that we should have a capital gains tax and that there does need to be some kind of progressive level of taxation. And what we're doing is having an argument about the details. You would think from some of the rhetoric that we're actually about to get to the barricades for a revolution between generations or between classes or when really what we're having is a fairly technical debate that will not affect a fair chunk of people who are outraged by it. So I just find it interesting seeing the scale and heat in the debate when in Australia our political spectrum, the mainstream political spectrum, really isn't that large.
Yeah. Can I just add completely without notice, but this is how I think in the weeds we've started to get in the debate around Pauline Hanson versus blah, 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 blah. Today's one of the big stories is that One Nation leader Pauline Hanson has revealed she hasn't spoken to Angus Taylor since 2019. Now, I don't really care to you. Sorry, if I lost my mind.
No, like, I didn't know that. I'd missed this, PK. So you're breaking the news
I'm
to me.
I'm kind of mocking the yard. So I'm not breaking the news. I'm saying to you, okay, like she's a right-wing leader of another political party. Well, why would she hang out with him so much? I don't know. Like, she hasn't spoken to him since 2019 when he was Environment Minister. Okay. Yeah, cool. I don't know.
When do you think the last time Angus Taylor would have spoken to Larissa Waters?
Good question. Maybe never.
You know, which
I'll
she
ask
has
if
a,
I get him on. Yeah.
She represents a larger portion in
well,
Parliament.
So far,
has a,
I don't know how long that's going to last.
Well, who knows for how long. But, you know, you do need to negotiate things in the Senate. But I'm sure that's been left to, you know, Senate leaders and manager of party business
in the
parties.
The point I'm wanting to make, because it's like, why am I saying this to you? I'll tell you what. I feel like Pauline Hanson kind of sneezes, which I feel like doing right now, sneezes, and everyone's like, oh my God, did you hear Pauline Hanson sneezed? Are we jumping a bit the shark? Like, have you noticed, like, she breathes and it's reported?
Well, this is what happens when she's the topic du jour, I think.
Yeah, I know why. And I'm part of the and it's interesting.
I don't disagree with you, PK. Yeah. I agree with you. There is a lot of analysing of things that are not new or particularly revelatory, but I think she is the water cooler topic and people want to find any new thing to say about the water cooler topic. I mean, I'm sure the World Cup is very much overtaking that right now, but I can assure you I've had 20 different conversations about Nestor Irinkunda, because that's a thing everyone wants to talk about right now. And I feel like Pauline Hanson's a bit in that category. People are just looking for anything because she's the hot flavour of the moment politically.
Look, I'm happy that I know when she last talked to Angus Taylor. That's it for politics now today. Tomorrow is Pauline Hanson's leader's address at the National Press Club, which I think is a big deal because it is, you know, the national forum for turning up, speaking to the nation's press gallery journalists and being asked some hard questions. So I think it's a good thing that someone who was outpolling the Prime Minister as preferred Prime Minister would be addressing such a space and being asked questions. I think it's such a good thing that David Spears and I are going to record later so we can bring you some reflections on the way she handles some of those questions.
And I will tune in to hear that episode because I'm keen to hear the post-match analysis as well. It is going to be really interesting, and I think we can agree as journalists, the more politicians subject themselves to scrutiny, the better. We're on a unity ticket there, PK.
Absolutely. See you, Mel.
See you, PK.